Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Googling Job Applicants conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the conference, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone to reach an operator. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your host for today's conference, Robin Jones. Please proceed.
Great, and thank you, and welcome everyone to the ADA Audio Conference Series, which is brought to you by the ADA National Network. We're happy that you're able to join us today, and people are joining us from a variety of areas across the country. We know some people are connected by telephone, as well as some people are on the webinar platform. Because of that, I'm going to go through a few slides of some of the logistics of today's technical parts of the session, and then I will turn it over to our session moderator and presenter. To be listening today, either broadcast through your computer or via telephone, depending on which option you registered for. If you're using your computer, please make sure your speakers are turned on and your headphones are plugged in. If you can, you can control the audio broadcast using the audio and video panel, adjusting the sound by sliding the soundbar left or right. If you have any quality sound problems today in the webinar platform, you can check your audio controls by going through the audio wizard, and that is on the audio and video panel. It's a little icon that looks like a microphone with a red star on it. If you click on that and go through the process, that will help you adjust your sound if you're having any problems on the webinar platform today. For those of you that are also using the mobile options, iPhone, iPad, Android, Kindle Fire, etc., you're listening through that application. Please note, though, that the closed captioning is not available in the app, and there's limited accessibility for screen readers using the mobile app. Captioning is available for today's session. Use the CC icon at the top in the audio and video panel. Once you've selected it, you'll have the option to resize the caption window, changing your font size, as well as saving the transcript. We will be taking questions today from our audience. You'll have an option to take questions through the chat room if you're participating through the webinar platform. Also, you can, if you're on the telephone, you will be given directions later by our operator as to how to submit questions. If you're on the mobile device, you also will be able to submit through the chat area as well. You also have the secondary option of sending an email to us at webinars@ada-audio.org, and we will transmit that question to the presenter for today's session. Again, as a reminder, the session is being recorded. It will be available on the archives page of the www.ada-audio.org website, and a written edited transcript will also be posted on that same site within 7 days following the conclusion of the session. You can customize your view today of what you're viewing. The whiteboard is that area where the PowerPoint presentation shows up. You can make it smaller or larger, and it will only change your actual view. The little drop-down menu at the top of the screen is default at Fit Page, but you can alter that depending on your own individual desire. You can also resize and reposition any of the boxes, chat, participant, audio, video panels by detaching them using your mouse or repositioning by stretching or shrinking them using your mouse. Each panel can be detached by using the little icon, I call it a bunch of lines on the page or a piece of paper, in the upper right-hand corner of each panel. The preferences, if you're hearing any dings or any notifications when somebody enters the room or anybody takes any action in the room, that means that your system has got preferences set to give you audible or visual notifications. You can customize those by going to the Edit drop-down menu at the top of your screen on the toolbar, choose Preferences, and then scroll down within the preferences to General, selecting both audible and visual notifications, making sure nothing is checked. If you're a screen reader, you can set your preferences through your settings window, settings option within the activity window, which is Control plus slash, and that will open your activity window. If you run into any problems today or have any issues with your technology or the telephone or anything, you can contact us at webinars@ada-audio.org or by calling us at 877-232-1990. You can also send us a message in the chat area as well. So we'd like to begin our session today, and at this time I'm going to turn it over to our moderator for today's session, which is Marissa DeMaia with the Southwest ADA Center, and she will go forward and introduce our presenter and give you additional instructions about how we're going to operate today's session. So at this time, I'm going to hand over the microphone to Marissa. Go ahead, Marissa.
Thanks, Robin. Good morning and afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the ADA audio conference series. Again, my name's Marissa DeMaia, and I'm with the Southwest ADA Center, and I'll be serving as moderator for today's session. This program is brought to you by the ADA National Network. The ADA audio conference series is offered monthly and covers a variety of topics related to the ADA. And today's session is titled Googling Job Applicants, and we are privileged to be joined by our presenter, Joe Bonke, from the EEOC Houston office. I'm going to introduce Joe in just a second. Individuals are joining us today using a variety of mediums, including the telephone, streaming audio on the internet, and real-time captioning. Individuals may also view today's PowerPoint online, so refer to your instructions for the URL. Again, as Robin mentioned, a written transcript of the session will be created, edited, and posted to the www.ada-audio.org website, along with a digital recording of the session within about 10 business days following the conclusion of the program. Now, our presenter will provide us with some valuable information today, and at the conclusion of his presentation, there will be an opportunity for everyone to ask questions. Again, the operator will provide instructions when we're ready to take questions. Depending on the number of questions, we may not be able to address all of your issues or concerns today. We encourage you to follow up with questions with your regional ADA center at 800-949-4232. So I'm going to begin today's session by introducing Joe Bonke. For anyone who doesn't know, Joe Bonke is the outreach manager and ombudsman for the Houston, Texas District Office of the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. He also currently serves as chair of the Texas Governor's Committee on People with Disabilities. He's been in the field of human resources and civil rights for about 24 years now, and has great experience in employment law and adult education. If you'd like a little bit more information to read Joe's full bio, you can go ahead and read that at www.ada-audio.org website. I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Joe here. Joe, welcome.
Thank you very much, Marissa. What an honor to be invited back to the ADA audio conference. But I'll be honest, when you work at the EEOC, it's an honor to be invited back anywhere. We are a federal agency, and we deal with a whole array of issues that often on tax day are not very popular to people. So I come from an agency that enforces civil rights in the workplace. And this community that is targeted today for this conference is the community of people with disabilities or those entities that educate or assist people with disabilities. And my hope is in the workplace, because that's the piece that I deal with. I don't speak for the agency, and this is the disclaimer to more or less tell you that the information here is offered as technical assistance. I am, however, available for questions, comments, concerns, criticisms via email or all of my phone numbers that we'll make available throughout this process. Our first slide here is, with tongue-in-cheek, one of those issues that half of the workforce is made up of the female population, where women are only earning 78 cents of what men earn. And the unemployment rate for veterans who serve on active duty or the armed forces since the Gulf War era is at an all-time high of 12.1%. The workplace being made up of an array of generations that I'm just teasing you now to be able to say will have an effect on our topic today, as will the other two groups that we've mentioned. So applicants, and is everyone getting the true picture? So if I were to Google these folks, whoever these folks are, what are the aspects that I'm learning? And what I hope to be able to accomplish in our time together is, where are the legal boundaries when we're looking at candidates? What's the return on investment of the sleuth who sits down at Google and attempts to find all this information? What's the current case history and some of the new tools of Googling applicants? There obviously is no prohibition against this, but the realizations of what we're learning is we will all do it differently. My philosophical approach to the topic is that we all come to the workplace, or really any place that we go, with this imaginary backpack on, and it's what we bring with us. It's our education, our life's experiences, our family of origin, cultural identity, all of our certifications and our formal and informal educations. And it's our stuff, and we filter an awful lot through that stuff. The realizations of that stuff is we don't leave it in our home or in our vehicle and then come to work. We come to work with our duties and responsibilities, and when we get there, we're going to have a peer group that will have experienced things similarly to what we've experienced. So I'm kind of an open book. I'm a baby boomer. I'm 56 this year. I was raised by traditionalists, my mom and dad, and I'm raising three Gen Yers. And, well, one of them went off and got married, and I thought I was getting rid of her, but she brought him home. So there's four of them in my life. All wonderful people, but I have realized that we do things differently. And suppose we were in a room where there were representatives of the traditionalists, the baby boomer, the Gen X, and the Gen Y, and we asked them to define the terms team player, effective communications, appropriate, and person with disabilities. Do you think the four groups would answer the definitions the same way? And my opinion is no. We will see things differently. There is no I in team. The team helps me perform. Effective communication, if I want to talk to my children, I better text them. I better not text my mother. I better call her. She won't find the text in her phone. My children won't answer their phone. Appropriate and casual, those are those emails that we get an awful lot of concern about, because what one person thinks is playful banter, another one might find offensive. And I have a very famous email that I sent out telling our interns to feel free to come into work casual. And boy, was I sorry I offered that suggestion. But what we're here today to talk about is the notion of a person with a disability. And I think generationally we will have drastic different understandings. People who are educated after or during the Rehabilitation Act will understand more of an inclusive mainstreaming, where prior to that it would have been much different. Or if in my backpack I don't have that comfort levels with somebody of a different ability, it may be problematic. So the dynamics are fascinating. Then when we look at the notion of protected categories that I'm sure in recent days you have become further aware of, the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which protects race, national origin, color, religion, and sex. We had the Americans with Disabilities Act, or ADAAA, as it's been amended, and the Age Discrimination and Employment Act. So I'm over 40. I'm using myself in that picture. That's me about 25 pounds ago. There are about 540,000 words in the English language. Five times as many as Shakespeare had during his time. The phenomenon of the internet has enabled us to publish 3,000 new books every day. And on your own time, you may want to go to YouTube and look up, is social media a fad? I'm not going to bore you with the 7 or 12 minute version of this, whichever one you decide to look at. But it is worth looking at on your own time, because I believe it's a fad that's here to stay. Now, in the digital age, and don't expect me to speak negatively about any of it, because I'm involved in all of it, and I really find it fascinating and enjoyable. I have my friends, my Facebook, my Instagram, that social network that at times gets me speaking engagements and connects me with long-lost classmates and friends. Then my connections, which I call LinkedIn, that Facebook in a suit. It's a little bit more formal. Or the Twitter, the instant followers, that instant messaging on steroids. If we were to peel the onion and look at this phenomenon, there's a billion registered users of Facebook. If it were a country, it would be the third largest in the world, somewhere between India and the U.S. And that's not including Twitter or what some people feel is the floundering MySpace, but it is having a bit of a resurgence to some extent. But employers are using it to take a peek at who they think they want to hire. And there is no prohibitions against this, and I hope there never is, because I think it's one of the tools that you can use to ensure that fit between the applicant and the organization. Anyone in the audience who thinks to themselves, have I ever had a bad hire? My hope is you're not pointing at anyone in the room right now without them seeing you, but we're aiming to find candidates with characteristics that are going to maximize the work productivity and minimize any of those problematic issues that may come our way. Here's the issue that I could call problematic, but it wasn't for me. It was for this young lady called Stacy Snyder. And Stacy will probably forever be known as the poster child of the First Amendment and the Internet. Stacy worked as a student teacher while she was 25 years old at a high school in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And because she had posted a picture on her social networking showing her at a party wearing a pirate hat and drinking from that plastic cup, somebody had captioned it "Drunken Pirate." So after discovering the page, the high school principal saw this and, in essence, complained to the dean of students and said, "This is unfortunate, but I think she's depicting herself in an unfavorable light." And the dean of students, again, maybe generationally, maybe not understanding the full breadth of what she was doing, because remember, she's 25 at this time, well of age to imbibe anything she wanted. The dean of students said, "A woman of this moral caliber who depicts herself in such a way in the town square of the World Wide Web is not fit to educate children." Therefore, her teacher certificate, and although she had made all of the requirements for her master's degree, had been denied. Now, you can imagine how upset she was, but anyone looking at this picture, I would caution you, can anyone say what's in the cup? So there's no evidence from that whether it is alcohol or non or whatever it is, but the perception became the reality. And the court said, "Stacy, while this is unfortunate, the First Amendment doesn't cover photos." And I know for myself, even if I try to remove things from the Internet, they're pretty much there forever. There's things that I'm never going to be able to get down, and every online photo, Facebook status update, Twitter post, or blog entry about us can be stored there forever. Problem or not, and as I look at my three children going through college, I realized, oh my God, we don't have a common name. If somebody Googles us, this is going to come up. And when you have a son who enters a beauty contest in his junior year at Sam Houston State University in drag, and wins, you realize where the father in me is concerned. Now, all that being said, a lot of students have come to me and said, "Joe, we have a problem where employers are asking us for our Facebook passwords at an interview. Can they do that?" And this took a little bit of research on my part, but it probably shouldn't have had I realized where the issue was. Now, while we would think, no, you can't do that, that's unfortunate, if somebody wants the job, they're probably going to jump through as many hoops as they can to get the job. However, there's a very good answer for this, And those of you who are on Facebook really already know it, but you don't remember it. Because at one point you signed up with Facebook and you hit a page that gave you an agreement between you and the software provider called Facebook. And one of those paragraphs said, for security purposes, never give out your sign-on or password to anyone else. And you hit a button that said, I agree. The problem is none of us ever read it, myself included. So now we have state legislative bodies creating law saying employers can't ask for passwords when the agreement contractually already exists between the provider and the applicant. Now, in the civil rights era, we understand that we come to work with all of these different backpacks and all these different past histories and qualifications and cultural identities, and we're given duties and responsibilities at work. And the obligation of the employers that shared with an employee is to understand rights and responsibilities. And my three bullets here are kind of important turning points in a lesson of how this all comes together. We need to make the workplace free of unlawful harassment, discrimination, and retaliation. What does that mean? Well, if somebody comes forward saying, I feel discriminated against or harassed or retaliated, the second prompt needs to come into play, to promptly and confidentially investigate complaints of discrimination, harassment, retaliation. And if it's found, third, where it's found, you take prompt and appropriate remedial action. So let's play this out in a hypothetical. Suppose Joe comes in every morning and says to Mary, how are you doing? And Mary feels this is compromising her environment and its harassment. The supervisor is made aware of this by Mary, and Mary says, Joe comes in every morning and it really freaks me out. He says, how are you doing? And I'm feeling uncomfortable. Now, at first glance, this may see how could Joe coming in every morning saying how you're doing be harassment. The supervisor may have to take prompt and confidential investigative action take a peek at this. What is Mary talking about? And may need to position herself in such a way that she can see Joe coming in and interacting with Mary. And when she knows, supervisor notices this, she sees Joe come in and maybe hovers over Mary's personal space just a tad too close. And instead of saying, how you doing, he says it like, how you doing? In a little bit of a creepy fashion. Now, Joe may need appropriate remedial action of retraining about personal space and about how he interacts with a member of the opposite sex or somebody who is his junior on staff or whatever the issue is. That being said, we have a standard of I don't know what's in somebody else's head, and their perception becomes the reality. Mary's perception of Joe coming in saying, how are you doing, was the reality of this is uncomfortable for me. I think the same can hold true when we look at the software of Google. I'm all for it, but where it comes into an issue is if I Google somebody's name, what do I get? Now I'm going to use myself as an example, and if you Google me, you're going to get me. There's only one Joe Bonke in the world that I've found so far. My wife would say, thank God. And you're going to see I have an EEOC Facebook education and outreach page. It's going to be a very different audience than my Santa Claus for the Jersey Village Fire Department, and that's a picture of my grandbaby when she was probably 18 months old. And this is going to be for my real friends and my real family and those people who I have had a long relationship with so that I can speak freely about issues of likes and dislikes and concerns. This is not my work people. This is not the people that I interact with in my business world. I'm going to save that for LinkedIn, want to join me. I don't know who you are, but if you think linking in with me is going to be of value, the more the merrier. Come on board. Very different audience for all three of those groups. My technical assistance folks on Facebook, now the EEOC has its own one, so I'm going to direct people to that one more often. My own personal Facebook, my LinkedIn page. The last example is going to be my Twitter page. I'm only following 14, 18 are following me. I don't know where we're going, though, and that's a problem. Because to me, I'm just getting warmed up in 140 characters, and that's what it's limiting me to. Now, I have had more posts since then, but the idea is it's not my cup of tea. In the Google realm, I've come across an application that is probably a wonderful company. They're from Palo Alto, California. It's a group that has an app called Fine.ly. And a few local retailers are using this as their application process. And I'm taking the position that if you're using an app that requires you to have a Facebook page where all of a sudden your resume are those things that you have in social media, you may in fact be crossing some imaginary lines that in reality don't exist. The lines aren't, nobody's forbidding anyone from putting pictures on resumes or telling you on your resume what your gender is or the list of all of your friends or any other information of clubs or services that you belong to. But Facebook does that, and when an application also does that, it begs the question, has the resume, in fact, gotten a little bit larger than it should be just for any given job? And my opinion would be, well, there's no laws. There are no illegal questions, I like to say. You can ask anything you want, but once you get that information, have you just given more protections as an employer than you really should have? And if you're looking for the most qualified applicant, is that going to be problematic? Begs the question. I don't have the answer for it yet. On Twitter, I'm saying that I know of 200 million users. Now, Twitter may claim to have more of that. Maybe I should say active users. But did you know that since its inception in 2006, that the Library of Congress has been acquiring and permanently storing every Twitter post? Now, let that sink in, because that may mean that everything that has ever been tweeted out, I have access to in the Library of Congress. And good, bad, or indifferent, it offers that Orwellian, for those of you who ever read George Orwell's 1984, The Big Brother Watching concept. Remember, 1984 is now 30 years ago, huh? And that was a futuristic concept. But I think we know that, yeah, the government will have an awful lot of our information at hand. Okay, that being said, everybody's entitled to their own opinion, not your own fact. Let's look at some important elements. The importance of a policy. So one of the things I learned in Twitter is a twoosh is a word invented to describe a Twitter message that contains exactly 140 characters. A good friend of mine and the deputy director of the Houston office, Marty Ebel, came up with a Twitter policy in 140 characters of this twoosh. Be professional, kind, discreet, authentic. Represent us well. Remember, you can't control it once you hit update. Now, that being said, how many of us have a personal policy as to what kind of electronic footprints am I going to put out there for all my potential future employers to see? Maybe we've thought about it, maybe we haven't, maybe people will just say, youthful indiscretion, they didn't know they were going to run for office, nobody had an idea that this was going to be important. And I think it is very important. I did a little unscientific study at a Texas A&M University to the student SHRM organization. That's the Society of Human Resource Managers. And I offered them an index card, and I think there were 75 in the room. And I said, I'd like you to use your smartphones or your laptops or your tablets or any other devices you have here, or just your own personal backpacks of life's experiences or your knowledge. And in the next 2 minutes on the index card, write down everything you can tell me about, at the time he was running for office, it was Congressman Anthony Weiner. And that's all the information I gave them. And then I shut up and for the 2 minutes walked around the room and watched these energetic, very savvy students using all of their devices to find as much as they can. And I said, when the 2 minutes are up, everybody pass your cards up. And I had one of the students tally up what we were going to learn from that. And out of the 77 cards, 75 cards, 60 of them said, he wears briefs, not boxers. Now, if the worst thing you've done is the first thing people will know about you, you would think we're in middle school. Well, unfortunately, for Anthony Weiner's postings, that's the most information in a two-minute time frame that people can find out. You would think if your name was Weiner, somewhere in middle school you would have learned what to post and what not to, but I digress. Okay, Microsoft did this survey where they said 75% of U.S. recruiters and human resource professionals report that their companies require them to do online research of candidates, and many use a range of sites when scrutinizing applicants. So let that sink in. More than half, three-quarters of the employers are using some kind of an online search, social networking sites, photos, video sharing, personal websites, blogs, Twitter, online gaming sites. 70% of U.S. recruiters report that they've had rejected candidates because of information found online, like photos, discussion board conversation, memberships, conversational groups. Let's pause there for a moment and let's take into consideration fact. I gave you the example that there's only one Joe Bunke. Now, the woman who said thank God was my wife, the love of my life, 30 years married this year. Joyce Smith is her name. Had we Googled her, we would have found that there are 4,800 Joyce Smith. Now, if a U.S. recruiter is doing a background search on Joe Bonke or Joyce Smith, how do they know they're finding the right one? And if I have a stack of resumes or electronic resumes or 400 applicants for these two jobs and I have to cull it down to a sizable amount, there may be an unfair issue rearing its head where people with like-sounding or same names come up with negative information. Another screening tool and another study said the numbers were a tad different. 65% of hiring managers Google the applicants, 65% check social networking sites, 50% result in job rejections. And as many searches as I've done throughout the English-speaking world, I found all sorts of proof that this is happening. Then in talking to the HR community, I since learned quite a bit more. Specific to this webinar, I want to address the notion that employers will have potentially access to information such as involvement in stakeholder groups, people with disabilities organizations, sexual preference, cultural and religious identification, that may in some form or fashion be less than comfortable for the decision maker. Now, what do I mean for that? What I have learned from EEOC investigators going out and doing on-site research or anecdotally HR professionals coming to me saying, what do I do with this information? And what the information very often is I had alluded to the Google sleuth, and it might be that supervisor who has the top 5 or 7 or 10 candidates for any given job that he or she has to make a decision on. And they spend X amount of time going into search engines, and particularly Google because it's the most popular, and Google searching as much information as they can narrow down for each of the applicants. And if they see something like, oh, John Doe rode in the MS-150, and print out a picture of John Doe in the MS-150, and write on that page, must have a disability, and then staple it to his resume, and then print out a picture from maybe MapQuest or Google Earth of the roof of a few of the candidates, because we could tell an awful lot by somebody's roof, or scan around the roof to be able to see maybe a little tyke's house in the back saying she must have children, or seeing maybe a wooden ramp at the back door or the staircase on the side of the house must have somebody with a disability, or looking at a lawn sign that may have a candidate that they may not see so favorably. Any of that information is now part of the Google search. And we take the position, if you can't ask about it in an interview, you shouldn't be Googling it online. And the problematic issue is nothing is reining in the Google sleuth at this point. Next slide. So let me introduce to you my lovely family. And these are all of us. So my mom at one point in her life was battling breast cancer. She's 4 years cancer-free now, doing fine. She's 85 this year. And on the far left of your screen is my smoking hot wife of 30 years, Joyce. And next to her is Jackie. She's graduating from UT Austin. Then me, my son, who's a reporter in Little Rock, Arkansas, KATV, the girl he was dating that week next to him. What can I do? My oldest daughter, Jillian, and her husband, Zach. And we're all in this race. And at the time, my daughter, Jillian, was leaving one job and was interviewing for others, and she's a counselor right now in Hutto ISD in outside of Austin. And I said, take that picture down from Facebook. Why is that, Daddy? Well, this shows that the bunkie women have a predisposition of, and some of you are mouthing, breast cancer. And under those protected categories, one of them is GINA, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. We have a number of these cases at the EEOC, but because of our confidentiality, I can't show you those pictures. I can show you this picture because I have these people's permission. And these are real life issues that are happening daily for people who have everyday concerns about health or concerns about membership in clubs or have all sorts of an open book like I am that are being interpreted unfavorably by somebody who has a little bit of information. From your watching of cop shows, you will know that if somebody pulls a car over and wants to search the trunk, or when somebody wants to come into somebody's house, there is an amendment to the Constitution called the Fourth Amendment, which prevents unreasonable search or seizure. So our home is our castle. And that's one area of the law that we think, doesn't this prohibit somebody from looking past what I have enabled myself to put out there? And I think the short answer would be No, there is no laws in the Constitution that protects us from anything on the Internet that I've been able to find. And then if we looked at common law or Electronic Communications Act of 1986 or the Federal Stored Communications Act, would any of those limit the rights of employers regarding interference with the privacy of employees? And I think the Fourth Amendment really doesn't extend to private employees. Employees don't constitute state action. So we're barking up the wrong tree here. Then we have other federal agencies that have taken a position, and one of them will be the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, enforces an act called the NLRA, the National Labor Relations Act, and they take the position that this clicking the like button on Facebook constitute what is a term of art called concerted activity, meaning if I am an employee and I have people who report to me as my friends on Facebook, and those friends on Facebook like something, or I as a supervisor like something, does that mean we have communicated about our employment in a favorable or unfavorable terms and conditions of employment? And Hispanics United of Buffalo decision would say, yes, it does. Is a Facebook like constitutionally protected? And Blaine versus Roberts is taking the position that it may in fact be protected speech if I'm talking about those issues of my workplace. If we go back to 1987 and the 87 concept of the Supreme Court first recognizing that unreasonable search and seizure protection before the Internet, where an employee has an expectation of privacy about certain things like his or her desk or file cabinets. And just pause for a moment. What's changed? Because I don't think that today in 2014 that my employer by any means would think what's in my desk or my file cabinet or my hard drive or any time I'm using Wi-Fi from the office, any of that is protected. So what has changed is maybe perception. In 2010, where a SWAT team officer who was recently broken up from his girlfriend used a department-issued device, I'm calling it a pager here, but it was kind of a highfalutin pager, and in the texting with his girlfriend, he said by them having access to that was a violation of the Fourth Amendment, but it was the department's, the city of Ontario's pager. So it was a moot point. So, you know, if we draw a line in the sand at this juncture and say, let's think about every employer, whether public or private, have a clearly drafted policy giving employees notice that they really have no expectation of privacy in company electronic equipment, whether it be for emails, phone log details, text messages, postings on social media, things that they've sent up to LinkedIn. Because any time you're connecting your employer to any of that social media, you're in essence now wearing, in quotes, their logo on your shirt and representing the organization. And I think most of us often forget that element. The Electronics Communication Act of 1986, primarily federal law addressing the concerns, exceptions were interpreted to mean that an employer maintains its own email system and assumes provider status. So a message in transmission or a stored message were the two areas that very often came into concern. It doesn't seem that this is going to be the area that any law is going to come about. And then let's look at some facts. How safe is the stuff that I'm putting out there? This is a fascinating piece of data that we could call fun fact from Splash Data's list of the 25 most common passwords found in the internet. 123456 was the number one. The number two, which just got bumped this year from the number one slot, was the word password. And number three is 1 through 8. And then if you look at a keyboard, you'll notice QWERTY is just that middle of the keyboard. Or ABC123, then little fun fact is I love you, number 9, trust no one, 24. And somehow monkey made it to number 7. So are we our own worst enemies? I don't know. And then under the Federal Stored Communications Act, we have the little fun facts of the Wiretapping Act. And often we hear of things like this when can I bring my cell phone to the meeting and record the conversations without anyone listening? And I'm in Texas right now, so yes, that's completely legal, as it is in 26 other states. But you really have to check because this is afforded by states' rights. And a little fun fact that the conversations between Linda Tritt and Monica Lewinsky, some were admissible in that case and some not, depending upon where the call originated from, whether it was Virginia or Maryland. So how this evidence is eventually coming into court in the long run often comes into play. But remember, we have no laws yet. And some are emerging. So don't gain access to an employee's website by either receiving private information through another friend or by going through a person or an employee's friend's list. We actually have legislation here in Texas with regard to cyberbullying, where if somebody poses as a non-existent person or somebody not themselves, they can be held liable for that type of bullying. And strangely enough, the organization or the cadre of people most hindered by this, by the testimony, were children with disabilities who were bullied online by other children. And while I was watching this pass the legislature, I thought, this new platform of the World Wide Web has become that playground where the bullies still exist. Now they're anonymous. So when we look at issues arising from monitoring employees, we've seen throughout history that there have been quite a few of them are applicants next. Well, back in 1996, there's a case called Smith versus Pillsbury, where a company's interest in preventing inappropriate, unprofessional, any type of crude or rude comments or even illegal activity over email outweighs an employee's privacy interest, which in the grand scheme of things is kind of an interesting line in the sand, but this may in fact be a moot point because this wouldn't come into play because we don't know where something would have originated from on the internet always. Sometimes it skips through many servers and it's next to impossible to find. I had alluded to the National Labor Relations Act earlier, and if you were to see this close up, the fourth bullet down, under the National Labor Relations Act, you have a right to discuss your wages and benefits and other terms and conditions of employment. And this is very often taken as a license that I can talk about work to anybody I want to. And very often people are, and I hear it on the radio, that you're forbidden to talk about your wages or we don't want airing our dirty laundry outside. Well, the Wagner Act, which is this law that has been around since 1935, actually offers that protection. And the National Labor Relations interpretation of it really comes to play in this view. And I'm giving you the USC number 29157. So this is an important crescendo where this federal agency's view is that monitoring employees' social networking activity has the potential of creating, this term of art, a chilling effect on employees' communication regarding these terms and conditions of employment. Now, how could this come to play? And the NLRB's website has many examples, but I often offer the caveat to audiences that if you're a supervisor or a manager or a lead and you have friended people who report to you, I suggest you unfriend them because of the number of cases that are on the horizon where people say, because she liked this or because he liked that or because he's interested in this, that's why I have been retaliated or harassed or discriminated against, and now in their mind it's evidentiary. And we've had a number of examples of that. I'll give you a real one from 2011 where Kansu BMW, which is a BMW dealership on the Miracle Mile, which I guess is just outside of Chicago, or maybe it's still in the city limits of Chicago. One of the salesmen was unhappy that on Customer Appreciation Day, they were going to offer Big K Cola, the off-brand from Kroger, and turkey, hot dogs, and white bread. And he thought, this is low rent. We're the BMW dealership. We should have a higher caliber of free food for our potential customers. And by tweeting this out, he got fired. Now, this is a non-union case. This is concerted activity because it involves discussion of employees about a condition of employment, how they would be represented to the general public. And I think this is, and by the way, long story short, he gets his job back. He gets a settlement. Why? Because there is protection for this. And whether or not everything will have to go to a case, I do see an ebb and flow that, yes, I am able to speak freely. I still have that First Amendment freedom of speech. However, the interpretation of that freedom of speech may fall flat in some people's minds. It's really why I started with the generational differences, because I think I have to always know my audience, always know the comfort levels of what I'm talking about to my different audiences, and how those audiences are seeing the particulars of maybe what I'm involved in. I'm all for people getting a freer or fairer playing field, but I don't often know what is acceptable in somebody else's mind. If we look at a best practice, maybe it's something of an acceptable use policy. And while I'm not here to create policy with anyone, I'm going to offer you in here and in the archive of this PowerPoint the next three slides that will offer basic content of what we're urging employees to take work-related complaints to HR before airing them out into the town square of the World Wide Web, clarifying that discipline will be imposed up to and including termination, establishing reporting procedures, reminding employees that email systems are not private, requiring employees to acknowledge that they've received it, prohibit unauthorized transmissions, define discipline, define whether email is automatically deleted after a certain length of time, and basically fill in the blanks here with regard to what you are allowed and not allowed to do with the computer that is a same tool you may have sitting on the couch in your pajamas in the evening that is now on your desk at work. Two very different uses of the same tool. And here's the problem. Victor Myler Schulenburg once was quoted as saying, a society in which everything is recorded will forever tether us to all actions, making it impossible in practice to escape them. Without some form of forgetting, forgiving becomes a difficult undertaking. I think it's the notion of the Anthony Weiner exercise where there isn't a second chance in the town square of the World Wide Web. Everything that you will see or do will have some form or fashion that the worst thing you've done is the first thing people will know about you. So as a dad of three kids, well, they're all adults now, I have taught them to be careful, be discreet, be prepared. And I think as my parents had taught me, it's one of those things that we pass on. I think it's the reminder that at any age, those electronic footprints that we leave behind can often be misinterpreted. And in that misinterpretation, are we doing something that can come back and haunt us? When an employer is basing their hiring decision on race, religion, creed, color, national origin, age, sex, disability, it may be against the law. But how is that to be proven? When information discovered leads to an employer's knowledge of information that would be illegal to use against an applicant in the hiring decision, that's the in red, things you cannot ask at an interview are the same things an employer cannot research. And why that is so important to this audience, where people with disabilities who are looking for jobs or who are looking for better jobs or who are very involved in different community organizations, will the decision maker in fact see that information and not be as enlightened as many of us are with regard to issues? So things to ask yourself when using social media. Is it valid? Does this information predict job performance? Is it job related? So was the information that my children left behind them while they were in college something that employers held against them? I don't know. They all left college with jobs, so I guess I'm blessed. Is it legal? Can't find any laws yet that have been passed. Information posted on the internet is often considered, in quotes, public domain. And it opens an organization to that perception of using that protected information. But I caution folks to the sleuth who is stapling those found informational things that is swaying a decision one way or another to the application packet. Once they do that, they have to keep it for 2 years or it's a record-keeping violation. And those are the things that an investigator finds or stumbles upon that may not be worth it. So it's probably worth considering a few protections, an off-duty conduct policy. Especially if I'm connected with an organization, have I checked that cyber reputation? What is the Google search turning up for me? And this is not happy stuff very often. It's usually things that can be interpreted less than appropriately. What's discoverable? I guess I haven't found anything that isn't discoverable yet, because if it's there in some keystrokes, it could be subpoenaed by an agency like ours. So it's everything that exists that, in 15 years' time, it has really changed drastically. I remember first coming to the agency where one of our cases probably took up about 80 storage boxes. And those 80 boxes now would fit on a flash drive. And that was just applications that they were looking at for a class case. Those realities of we have become faster to research this information is not necessarily unique to any other law enforcement agency, but it seems as if the electronic footprints that people leave behind may be their own worst enemies. So there's a unique problem with social networking activities because the tool, like I said earlier, the tool that's on my desk blurs that line between work and when I'm using the same tool at home. We often don't think of the filter or edit, whether it's the smartphone that I have on in my hand or on my commute into work on the bus, I'm texting or status updating or tweeting. The audience, I don't even know how many people are getting it or seeing it. I think LinkedIn is the only one that's kind of pulling the curtain back, and you could see who's looked at your stuff the last couple days. But what's immediately there for the public viewing, I got up at the middle of the night and took a picture of the red moon last night and posted it to Facebook and went back to bed, and lo and behold, woke up to a number of people who were also doing the same thing. So while it's less formal, I think we're less guarded or careless, you know, admitting to going off to a cruise or a trip or on my way here is just telling folks that I'm potentially leaving my house empty, or if that undesirable information is out there for the underworld to be able to see, or is my association with some of the wonderful organizations connected to myriads of conditions or disabilities. I have dyslexia and dyscalculia, and my availability to be part of those organizations, does that in fact make me less of an applicant? Because it's not on my resume, but it's in my electronic footprints. I don't know. I don't have a good answer for it. When we think of terms of background checks, we often think of it as, does this meet job readiness and is it consistent with business necessity? So the EEOC puts out guidance on this with regard to criminal background checks, and we get a lot of press on this, that people are telling us we have to, in the government, or the EEOC is saying you have to hire felons for jobs. And I don't think anyone ever said that. I think what is being said and has been from our guidance for the past 13 years is look at the nature of the crime that the conviction was for, how much time has lapsed, and what's the job the person's applying for. Is there a consistency with business necessity? Somebody who is a child predator is never going to drive a school bus, is never going to work in a daycare or a school system. That's a given. But if somebody had a youthful indiscretion of minor in possession, and now it's 20 or 10 or 30 years down the road, are they the same person? And should it be held against them? And I think we often have to dump out our backpacks and look at the rationale as to, in this business decision, do we keep this information? And again, when I'm talking about criminal background checks, we have to do individual assessments. I'm trying to get more of the HR community to understand the same holds true for all of our Google searches. But in the criminal background check world, we look at, is there a name change? Was there an educational opportunity? Was there a long, successful employment history since the conviction? What was the length of time, how old were they, were their rehabilitation efforts, was there deferred adjudication, is this multiple postings or multiple county documents for the same offense, is it in fact identity theft? A whole array of things may come into play. I think it was the O2 Bureau of Statistics study that said 55% of ex-offenders under the age of 18 released were reconvicted within 3 years, and by contrast, 30% of ex-offenders 45 years or older during the same period of time were not. So, there's obviously a maturing element of it. And next slide. And then with tongue-in-cheek, sometimes we have to realize that between Snoop Dogg and Martha, remember, only one of them is a convicted felon. So be careful of our own stereotypes and those rationales. Martha would not like that slide at all. Statistically, do we know our own state's history of a snapshot of race, religion, sex, disability, age, national origin, retaliation? What are those statistics? And our website would show you those by state. I'm just pulling out Texas here as an example. Trapster is another great piece of software, an app that is free, and I'm not here to sell it or to encourage you. I saw it on my son's phone. And I said, why do you need that, Jordan? He said, well, I get a lot of speeding tickets, which isn't a good thing. And wouldn't it be nice if there was a way to see what the EEOC was looking for? And there is. While it's not in an app, it's called our Strategic Enforcement Plan. And I just want to run through six of the elements that we are using our minimal resources towards. Most people have the perception, oh, you're a huge federal agency. Did you know that there's only 2,200 of us nationwide? There's only 19 that do the job I do as the outreach manager and educational person. And that our budget is the equivalent of a McDonald's cup of coffee per citizen once a year. So in putting that into the notion of minimal resources, these six areas that we're trying to eliminate systemic barriers of recruitment and hiring, we're looking for employers who are using some type of exclusionary barriers to consider that individuals with disabilities shouldn't work here, or women or older workers or ethnic or racial minorities are excluded from hiring. And some of what we're finding is those electronic footprints. We're also trying to look towards the vulnerable workers who may be unaware of their rights under EEO or reluctant or unable to exercise them with regard to disparate pay or segregation or harassment or the common modern-day slavery of human trafficking that is prevalent. And the third issue is the ADAAA, this emerging issue that in last year's statistic was one of the higher cadres of litigation that we actually targeted. Under the third heading, the audience that we're here today to talk about, this emerging issue is better protections than the ADA offered, where very often we had to show proof that somebody was a person with a disability. It has become much, much easier, and now all we have to determine is, was that individual accommodated? So I very often encourage people to use our process. While there is, per se, no protected category for gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender, under Title VII provision, which is sex discrimination, very often the harassment issue is coming forward, and it's based on sex or sexual identity or sexual persuasion, and that's still sex discrimination. Issue three, pregnancy discrimination, which fascinates me that we still discriminate women during their childbearing years, yet we all have belly buttons and we all came from a pregnant woman. It is odd that we still see this kind of discrimination. And while the date has just passed last week, Equal Pay Day, some of you may have recognized it and some of you may have just seen it come and go. I produced this before realizing it was going to be before I realized it was going to be after. But April 9th is the day women had to work in 2014 to earn what men earned last year. And I have assisting me in this slide my granddaughter, Kate, who is working that kitchen. I had to put that kitchen together, and if I have anything to do with it, that's the only kitchen she will ever work in, because don't we have to leave the world better for those behind us? And my hope is that in my 10 years that I still have to work, I can make an effort where Equal Pay Day will be a recognition of how women used to be treated and no longer problematic in society. And the last two issues, preventing access to the legal system, where people are asked to sign agreements that you will be forced into an arbitration or some kind of a mediation as in lieu of invoking your civil rights in some other entity, and then combating harassment on all issues and doing what we're doing here, targeted outreach specific to the community of people with disabilities, is actually part of the strategic plan. All of that being said, one of the things that I promised at the beginning was to at least scratch the surface to be able to show some of the realities that are there and some of the things that we can look towards as a solution or a concern or how we can best move forward from here. And I want to show you a few companies that are doing different services. And the first one is reputation.com. I first became aware of it through NPR, probably a great company. I don't have a relationship with them. But part of their mission is to promote yourself on the Internet, create and establish an online presence, look better to HR directors, loan officers, romantic prospects. So what they will do is clean up your electronic footprints to a degree and do searches so that you look better in a Google search. There's a fee for this. I'm not recommending anyone do it. I'm just saying this happens. And I guess people are seeing a value of that. Or careerexcuses.com. And the first time I came across this, I was fascinated because in the box here, you'll see you have a bad reference, a weak resume, were you fired? We can help. We will act as your past employer and have operators standing by to give you that great reference you need for any inquiries. Join now, and we'll be able to create a career with a work history and a pay raise you see fit. Keep reading to find out more. So this is not illegal. This is somebody who will, in essence, lie for you, or for lack of a better word, or embellish your resume. And, you know, my wife and I spent an awful lot of money sending our children to college, and all we needed was an account with this group, strangely. Or the last one, fakeyourjob.com. So this is an interesting group where you think, what does it do? And as you look through the page, welcome to Fake Your Job. And you really have to go to their frequently asked questions. And under their FAQs, they say, the first one, is what you're doing legal? A kind of scary thought when the first question being asked is what you're doing legal? In short, yes, although people may find this act to be unethical, it is legal as long as you're not trying to defraud or fabricate yourself to a local, state, or federal government. Okay, so can I go to jail or arrested for using your service? If you're doing this for employment or renting a place to live, no. However, you're trying to deceive a government entity, you very well could get fired or thrown in jail. So know that these things are there, and know that very often we ask for references or give me some phone numbers. And did you know that for a very low price you could disguise your caller ID so that if I'm giving you three phone numbers, they could all be ringing on my iPhone and my voice could even be altered by this software, and my caller ID could be changed to whatever company I told you they were. Or the last example where too confusing, just we had the guy who just went out and bought three throwaway phones, labeled them which companies they were, and answered them accordingly. So it kind of begs the question that when we go through an array of information here, what is truth? How do I determine what is real? And this is a very, very difficult thing to talk about, because if I'm in the town square of the World Wide Web, You have seen Madison Avenue use this. Well, of course it's true. I read it on the Internet. And there's a great quote from Abraham Lincoln that says, everything on the Internet is not true, which I just kind of smirk at, because the rationale here is, how do we come to truth? So I'm going to conclude with a bit of a gimmick, and I'm going to, in a second, put a paragraph up on the screen, and I'm going to ask you to read. You don't even have to read it. I want to leave a little time for Q&A. Count how many of the letter F are on the screen. Hold that number in your brain. You will possess a truth. You will know what you saw. Count how many F's, like in Frank, are there. Hold that number in your brain. And depending upon how many you saw, some of you would have seen three, some of you would have seen four or five, maybe some even six or seven. There were eight. Go back to it. Finish file, one, two, of, we all forget, three, four, five, six, experience spelt wrong. Oh, no, somebody fixed it. the reality is, next slide, is your perception sometimes your truth? So sometimes we have to take another look at what we think we know. And in conclusion, all I want to offer is the picture that I have left on the Internet my best resume? And all too often, only we can answer that. So I'm going to, in the remaining 12 minutes here, offer any questions, comments, concerns, or complaints, and we'll be standing by to answer them.
So, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the star, then the number one key on your touchtone telephone. And if your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. We'll wait to see if we have any questions. And once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the star, then the number one key on your touchtone telephone. And it does look like we have a question from the line of Rick Edwards. Your line is open.
Yeah. I have a question. My name is Doug Hughes. I say proposal. I put something on the Internet, and it has to do with my schooling. But then it doesn't look quite as presentable than it should look, whether it's capitalized or not. What should I do?
It's a very good question, Doug, that if something is out there that you're not happy with, how do you get it back? Lends the question that if it's already connected to somebody else, we're going to have a difficult time pulling it back. I think changing it to the best of your abilities is appropriate. But I'll give you a quick example. I used to be the associate director of HR at a hospital here in town called MD Anderson Cancer Center. And at that time, a picture of me was put out on the Internet. I don't look like that anymore. I'm now 23 years older, much grayer, and I show up to speak someplace, and they find that picture of me on the Internet, and people are wondering why he sent his father. And I can't get that picture removed, or if I wanted to go through a reputation.com, it would cost an awful lot of money. So it depends upon how egregious is the issue and how much of the web, the actual web, those octopus tentacles or those web fibers are out there that I'm able to pull it back in. I hope that helps, Doug.
Oh, yes, it does.
Thank you for listening.
Okay. We'll go to a couple that came in just now. The first one that just came in is, what are your thoughts regarding photos and comments other individuals put on the web about you?
It's as bad as the realities of we have this availability of anonymity on the internet. Most of you are probably aware that the Ku Klux Klan was forbidden to spew hate while hooded. They said if you want to march, you have to take your hoods off. In other words, take off the anonymity. It seems as if much of the comments and opinions that are offered in newspaper articles and Twitter posts are done under the hood of anonymity that lends itself to I'm not responsible for any of these actions. And it gives the bully, the harasser, the hater, the discriminator full rein. I don't think there will be any actions to remove that, although certain newspapers have decided not to allow comments to be made without authorship. And I think that's a good thing, that if I can't at least stand behind my handle or my actual name, then I shouldn't have a voice. And I think that's removing the hood of anonymity. But we see dissing in a whole array. And it, at the EEOC, our lives have changed drastically in the last 10 years with regard to evidence coming in of harassment, retaliation, and discrimination from texting and sexting and all sorts of electronic evidence that comes into intake.
Okay, another question. What if a job seeker experienced fraud when someone posed as them on the internet, posting harmful things about them? How would that job seeker recreate their electronic footprint?
Oh, that's a really difficult one and an excellent, excellent question, because the job seeker seeing something there, whether it's them or whether it's somebody who has a similar name, I do a lot of speaking with a young lady who had a common name, and unfortunately somebody who had her name had a terrible criminal record. And here you had an attorney in one part of the country and a crook on the other side of the country with the same name. Your example is when somebody is posing as another person. There are some state laws against that, as I gave earlier, but how do you get to the table or get to the interview to be able to combat that, saying, you know, there's some stuff out on the internet about me that I'd like to address? And I think that might be worthwhile if given that opportunity. If the Google sleuth is finding that information before you had a chance in the interview seat, I don't know if there's much you could do about it. But that is a very unfortunate one.
Okay. One that came in just a second ago. Do you recommend adding an electronic access policy to personnel manual?
Oh, most definitely. That acceptable use policy that I'm giving you, or if you just want to do a search on it, most universities have their policies online. I like to offer to folks, edit them, make them your own. Put a work group together to put into policy how we will use electronic content and what we will do with it. Why is that so important? Why everybody understands the limitations or the breadth or scope of it may in fact be a comfort level with how much I understand. And I have bumped into people every day saying, I'm not going anywhere near that. I'm not going on Facebook. I don't have anything to do with it. I don't want that stuff out there. And that's their right. I have rekindled relationships from grade school. I chat with family over in the Ireland and the UK and am able to do that for free, and I enjoy that element of it. Am I giving up some to gain some? Maybe. But I think we take into consideration what can I get to make my own. And for those of you who are in need of a policy, find somebody's and edit it. We used to call that plagiarism. Now we call it word processing. And it's, and I would encourage it. Or if somebody's looking for that information, the Society of Human Resource Managers site has some examples. HRHero.com has some more. These are all free places to look. And my hope is the EEOC will eventually come up with something of a policy to direct people to it.
Okay. Charlotte, do we have any questions that have come in on the teleconference at this point?
At this time, I'm not showing any further questions on the telephone.
Okay. We'll go right to the next question. If I learn unfavorable information through a Google search, what aspects may I take into consideration? For example, if someone has many references to drug or alcohol use and abuse, may I decide not to interview or hire him or her?
There's no laws against this. So is it valid? Is it the real person? Is the picture that you're seeing them acting as a 60s individual, or is it in fact not baby powder on the mirror? These are all real concerns, but I go back to that pragmatic approach. If I can't ask it in an interview, I can't research it online. What if I stumble upon it online? If I'm using it as a decision maker and I can't sit across from the table and ask the person, I'm going to say take it off the table because I may have stumbled upon it and it may not be valid. And I would question the individual first. Then if they're in rehab, they're going to be protected under the ADAAA, and that's also a concern because now I presumed that they had a disability and that third prong of ADA will give them protection. So the what-if clause rears its ugly head here, and I want to keep you out of our offices through this preventative measure of good stewards of policy and practice.
Okay. I think we have time for one last one. It's a pretty good one, Joe. What if a search committee member decides to Google a candidate and informs the search committee? So is the committee now, or does the committee now have to Google the remaining candidates to ensure they're providing equal opportunity?
It's a really good point. If I Google one, do I have to Google everybody? And while I've never seen a policy like that, it is, in essence, treating all your applicants the same way. It's kind of why I throw out that teaser that if you Google Joe Bonke, you get him. If you Google Joyce Smith, you're going to get the 4,800. The rationale is we are not all open books because of the, how standard our name is, and that's the unfortunate variable. But I think a good mechanism would be as consistent as possible. And if you didn't get an opportunity to ask questions, you see on the screen there my name, my address, my office, even my cell phone. I really am as accessible to you as I can be. If I can't find the answer, I'm going to point you in a direction where I think you'll be able to find it because I'm from the government. I'm here to help, and thank you for your time and attention.
Okay. Well, actually, Joe, I think that was our last question. I want to go ahead and say this actually concludes today's ADA audio conference program. We realize that some of you may still have questions for Joe, so we apologize if we didn't get to them. You can, as he just said, contact him or email us or your ADA center if you still have questions, and we'll be happy to get those answered. And we want to thank Joe again for sharing your time and your wonderful knowledge with us today. I think everyone certainly learned a lot from our program. Just a quick reminder that the digital recording of today's session, as well as a written transcript, will be available for viewing and downloading on the www.adaaudio.org website within the next 10 business days. Thanks again, everyone. You may now disconnect from the platform.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in today's conference. This does conclude the program, and you may all disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.